Funding for Think comes from SMU Doctor and Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're living in a pleasant place, economically prosperous, regionally influential, and growing. You feel safe raising your children there, going out at night, being home alone. And then, without warning, that sense of security is shattered by a series of diabolically cruel murders, first of black servant women, then of socially prominent white women. And then, again with no rhyme or reason, the killer recedes. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Such was the scene in Austin in 1884. It was many decades before we'd even invented the term serial killer, but surely that was the right term for the monster who terrorized Austin for a solid year. And tragically, the crime's victims extended beyond those stalked and killed to at least a dozen innocent African Americans tried for the crime, based less on evidence than on the fact that the city's white law enforcement officials simply assumed the perpetrator was part of some mythological gang of rogue black men. 3 years after Austin's killer vanished, a murderer dubbed Jack the Ripper began his horrific run of attacks in London. Neither was ever caught, leading some to ask whether the two cities' nightmare might be the work of the same person. Skip Hollinsworth is executive editor at Texas Monthly, and throughout his career has brilliantly documented true crime stories. But this mystery, this one obsessed him like none before or since. Hollinsworth's first book is called The Midnight Assassin: Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. Skip, welcome back to Think.
Thank you very much.
You actually learned about the existence of this Texas serial killer when you were reading up on Jack the Ripper.
Yeah, and there was this line that said that Scotland Yard officials wondered if the killer of these prostitutes in the Whitechapel district of East London had come from a small city in Texas where a series of similar murders had occurred a few years earlier. Well, you know, this was my wheelhouse. And I went, what murders in Texas? And I stepped back into a world that, of course, began to possess me in sometimes horrific ways, where I became convinced that I was going to be able to figure out who this killer was. And like so many others who had gone down the same path, you know, I became sort of consumed with the story, looking for some piece of evidence somewhere, because Austin in 1884 was only 17,000 people. Surely someone had to know who this brutal, brilliant killer was. And who was slipping out of his house to do these killings. And I said, there's got to be some scrap of evidence somewhere locked in an old police file or in someone's attic that would give me the hint to identify the midnight assassin.
How did police take notes on crime scenes back then, and how did they preserve evidence?
Well, they didn't preserve evidence except for footprints. If some footprints were found or shoe prints were found around a body, they would sometimes pour plaster of Paris in the print and then pull it out so that they would have an actual print to carry with them back to the police station. Or they would do a drawing, put a sheet of paper around and trace the footprint. But that was essentially the only physical evidence that they used. Back then, the science of criminology had not been invented. There were no such thing as fingerprints. There was no such thing as blood typing. No one understood that the way blood spattered against a wall might help identify how the murder was created. There was no DNA, of course. There was just basically, if a cop could not find an eyewitness to the killing, he depended on bloodhounds who would bring into each murder scene, and these baying old dogs hopefully would pick up a trail and then follow it to the killer, which almost rarely happened.
I've wondered about that. Like, how did they train them, and how did they prove that they were getting the right person without additional evidence? You wonder if all the bloodhounds of the past were just, you know, literally barking up the wrong tree.
Well, but the bloodhounds, who knows what the barking was, but the bloodhounds were sort of famous. I mean, there was one bloodhound that was brought in from the state prison in Huntsville to sniff around, and he got confused and actually laid down on the ground, upset that he couldn't follow a scent, which was very significant to everyone that this particular bloodhound could not follow the trace of the killer. But there was so much blood at these scenes, there was literally too much blood for the bloodhounds.
Hmm. So Austin in 1884 was a place very much influenced by antebellum social ideas, which is to say white people had all the power.
Well, of course, it was only 20 years when these killings began. It was only 20 years after the end of the Civil War. But at the same time, what I found most interesting about the killings was that they began just as Austin was beginning to transform itself from this sort of frontier era town to a to an actual Gilded Age city. Electric lights were arriving. Telephones were arriving. The state capitol was getting built. A man named Colonel Driscoll was building a hotel in Austin, four stories high with flush toilets at the top floors, which had never been before seen in any building west of the Mississippi. There was a new opera hall. There was a new state lunatic asylum that had been refurbished. So Austin was transforming itself into a modern city, and with the arrival of modernity came modern crime.
You tell a story at the very opening of the book of indifference by a former Texas Ranger that I have to tell you is just about as chilling as the accounts of any of the murders that follow in the book.
I've already forgotten the book. Thanks a lot, Chris.
Tom Chalmers and Walter Spencer.
Oh, okay.
In a panic, goes to his door.
So here was this city. The mayor was talking about Austin entering a golden new age. Everyone believed it. Austin was on the rise for the first time in many, many years. And on December 30th, this black man knocked at the door of the home of an ex-Texas Ranger named Tom Chalmers, who said that the servant, he lived in the back servant quarters with a servant woman named Molly Smith, and he said he had been hit over the back of the head with a hatchet or an axe or something to knock him out. And when he awoke, Molly was gone. There was blood all over her side of the bed, and he needed help finding her. And Chalmers essentially pushed the man out the door and said, this is a matter that can wait until daylight. And his big concern was that the black man was leaving blood on the floor, which he had to wipe up. And so it was this kind of callous disregard to the fact that a murder had taken place because the woman was black.
And sure enough, Molly Smith was the first victim of this serial killer.
She was found in the backyard, her head nearly cleaved in two by an axe. She was stabbed repeatedly up and down her body to the point that when the black undertaker arrived with a small wooden casket to put her in, when he and an assistant lifted her up, pieces of her body fell off and landed on the ground. She was chopped up that much. She looked like a calf who had been slaughtered at a slaughterhouse. And it was such a vicious crime that this is where we get into the racist attitude. No one thought that a white man could possibly do such a killing. It had to be done by a depraved black man and someone who was not educated, who was still sort of connected to his primordial past, as they called it. And there was this attitude that black men still had this kind of primitive nature in them. And clearly, it was a black boyfriend or ex-boyfriend who had done the killing.
And yet they went and talked to the ex-boyfriend, and he was like, I don't have any problem with these people. They couldn't find enough evidence to convict him.
They arrested him on suspicion of murder, mm-hmm. which is not the same as arresting him on murder, but they had no evidence to convict him. He was last seen at a certain location. He would have had to run in a dead sprint for about a mile and a half to commit the murder and then run back. And so they let him go, but they just assumed it was another ex-black lover who had done the killing. And so it was just a matter of time before they found this man.
And then there's another murder, so that it's not just about one person, you know, having a complaint with this woman and her current lover. How did people respond to the second incident?
So the second woman was also a black servant woman. And her name was Eliza Shelley, and she was found wrapped in blankets called counterpanes. And then she was, when they unwrapped her, found her in her servant quarters, she too had been hit in the head, axe with in the head. And also it looked like some kind of iron rod had been driven through her ear. And she had been left there to die in front of her children. The police arrived and decided, well, it has to be another ex-boyfriend. somebody who got the idea of killing Eliza, that just like someone had gotten the idea of killing Molly. So he imitated the same killing. And so they arrested a man who used to have a kind of romantic crush on Eliza, a mentally slow, barefoot black man. And he was arrested for suspicion of murder.
And not convicted.
And not convicted.
All right, we're speaking this hour with Skip Hollandsworth, executive editor at Texas Monthly, about his new book, The Midnight Assassin, Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. We'll be back to our conversation with him in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like Margie Evans, nationally published creative writer. More at smu.edu/MLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. Little reminder that next week we will be in Washington, D.C. for a week of live shows. They are taking place from the NPR headquarters there in Washington, D.C. You can follow along by listening on the air. And, of course, we have the hashtag ThinkInDC, so you can find out what's going on throughout the trip. Returning now to my conversation with a guest for the hour, Skip Hollandsworth. He's executive editor at Texas Monthly and has a new book out called The Midnight Assassin, Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. Join us at 800-933-5372. Crime journalism has come a long way in 132 years, and although these were just horrific stories, it had to sort of make you smile to look at these, like, blaring, alliterative headlines. Can you talk a little bit about the way the media covered this series of crimes?
Well, the reporters were actually remarkable stylistic writers. They clearly were doing their best to imitate Edgar Allan Poe. They did love to use alliterative phrases, gory, glaring, you know, on and on and on. They loved to set the scenes of what the bodies look like. You know, at one point when one of the murders took place of the white women, a Fort Worth reporter went on and on about how she looked like this angelic death pose. There was this richness of the writing. What wasn't happening was any investigative reporting. There was nobody sort of writing speculative articles about who could do this. They just sort of went along with this same racist filter that it had to be some black man. And as each murder took place, there'd be another black man arrested. And when it began to realize, and at some point the attitude changed to not just one black, not just different black ex-lovers, but then came the theory that a black gang was at loose, wreaking havoc in Austin, that it was a group of black men who had been hired by a union to persuade black servant women to join the union to ask for higher wages. And if they didn't join, they were massacred. Now, as ridiculous as that is for us to believe, it was actually considered quite reasonable, a theory among the conservative businessmen of Austin and among the reporters.
You've mentioned already two of these murders. In both cases, there were people at the scene left alive. In the second case, it was just kids. In multiple cases, there were people around who had been sort of asleep when the victim was taken. A couple of people, kids, caught glimpses of who this person was. Why could nobody come up with a description of who was doing these things?
There's not enough. I have no one to go interview to ask that question. Mm-hmm. You know, basically, there was someone left alive at every scene. Either children were chloroformed or knocked other servant women. At some point, as the murders continued, servant women began to huddle together and sleep together for safety in numbers in the servant quarters. You know, in one of the most grotesque of the killings, the killer knocked three people unconscious, then dragged the fourth woman out to the backyard and beat her face in with a brick until it looked like, in the account of one reporter, jelly. But no one except for two little boys got a glimpse of the killer. And one of the boys thought, well, he might be black. And one of the boys thought, well, he's probably white. But the killer's face was never really revealed to them. And so that makes these killings even more eerie, is that the guy showed up with the deliberate motive to murder a particular woman and leave potential eyewitnesses. What kind of killer does that?
What do you think are the chances that it was more than one person acting independently?
Well, here's the ultimate problem with writing this history. There's lots of blank spots in the narrative. There are places where we don't have enough evidence. There's lots of holes in the case, which means that anyone can impose his or her theory as to who did it upon this set of facts as we have them and come up with a theory, come up with a killer or set of killers. And you can't quite deny, say that that's completely untrue. I mean, it's like throwing a hanging curveball. It just lays out there for anyone to hit. You just can't say for certain it was this person or it was not this person.
So your friends and family at some point started to get worried about you because you just could not let this story go.
There's a group of researchers in England who are known as Ripperologists because they want to figure out the identity of Jack the Ripper. And they spend hours at the public library sifting through the government records that are available, the autopsy photos of these victims. And they spend even more hours researching who might possibly be a killer. And that's why you have so many different suspects in Jack the Ripper. Well, there's the same thing happening at a much lesser scale in Austin. I call them Austinologists. These are researchers who just cannot let the story go because they think, like I did, that the killer has got to have left some trail of evidence, something that would let us identify him. And we're all sort of nuts. We're all a little insane and depraved. And, you know, you start smelling. One person said, I look like one of those JFK assassination researchers down at the sixth floor museum. Musty smelling, unbrushed hair. Stop it and go off and do something else, which I did, and would leave the story behind for a year or two and then find myself drawn back to it.
You traveled to see if being in certain locations would give you more information?
Well, yes, and that was this kind of dramatic conceit, which of course led to nothing because almost everything is gone. You know, the house where across the street from Schultz's Beer Garden, where one woman was found nearly scalped like a Comanche Indian attack, that's now a parking garage. Hmm. The house where one of the women was found lobotomized with another ice pick driven through her ear, that's now the Four Seasons Hotel. So, Molly, so you can't retrace history like that. I mean, there's still some of the old buildings. Of course, the Driscoll's there. The state capitol is there. There's these remnants of that era. But there's just so little physical evidence, and there are very few police reports.
Given the focus of your career, and I know you've written about other things as well, but you've done a lot of crime. Do you walk around looking at people and thinking, you know, anybody on this, you know, park bench in front of me, anybody passing by on a bus, anybody that I'm, you know, walking past, you know, in a shopping center could be up to something really diabolical and it wouldn't show?
No, Chris, I'm not that depraved.
but I mean, like you've written about a lot of people who don't appear dangerous.
Well, I am interested in people that seem normal, like you and I, who walk up to this line and step over it. And what drives people to commit these acts of such violence and sometimes such grotesque murder? Why go to that extent? And it's always a mystery, regardless of the case you have, that attracts me.
Do you think it's about mental illness, or do you think there is such a thing as accountable pure evil?
I thought when you asked that question, do I think it's mental illness that you were referring to me?
No. I'll leave that to the people who know you better.
No, I don't think it's pure evil. And sometimes I don't think it's mental illness. I just sometimes think people will commit crimes out of desperation. Sometimes it is definitely out of a psychotic. Serial killers are especially, there is a kind of psychotic, unknown need to ritualistically slaughter a series of people to gratify some unknown lascivious urge within himself. The first crime story I worked on was the case of the intelligent Renaissance man who lived in South Dallas who would slip out of his house at night, shoot prostitutes in the back of his head, back of their heads, and then cut out their eyes and keep the eyeballs. And where they went, no one knows.
In the early 90s, right?
In the early 90s. Yeah. And the famous Charles Albright. And he let me come talk to him. And here I did, was my chance to watch a man of such interest and normalness in some ways, who also had a side to him that was so grotesque and just needed to do this kind of act. And I was hooked.
What do you think when you walk away from a meeting like that and you think, there were things about that guy that I kind of liked in casual conversation?
Well, I think any journalist who writes about crime will often say there are people that, regardless who they interview, there tends to be something likable about a criminal, you know, that they do have likable qualities. They are interesting to talk to. They are good conversationalists. Many of them do have good family lives. So there's always that duality that's part of the attraction of writing these kind of stories.
So the last two documented victims were these two white women who were, you know, considered members of polite society. But there had been other incidents. There were other maybe would-be victims. It's hard to say that the person who, you know, went after them was the same person. But they were two Swedish girls, right?
Well, at one point during the killings, or periodically, there would be attacks on servant women that either the killer backed away from or he just came to scare the women. And so there were two Swedish servant girls, not all the servant women in Austin were black, who were attacked, beaten up. One was actually shot after the attacker had left. Was that the same killer as the one that had done all the other killings? Probably, but maybe not. And the police were convinced when the two white women, members of white society, were murdered on Christmas Eve, almost exactly 1 year after the killing started, that two copycats were on the loose. And the copycats, the police announced, were the two husbands of the two women who had individually, on their own, decided at the same time to murder their wives on Christmas Eve and make the murders look like the killings of the black gang, so that the suspicion would be diverted away from them, the husbands. It is a preposterous theory. Yet these two husbands got arrested for coming up with copycat murders.
We're speaking this hour with Texas Monthly executive editor Skip Hollandsworth. His new book is called The Midnight Assassin: Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. If you'd like to join us, you can email think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Back in 2 minutes with Skip Hollandsworth.
Funding for Think comes from the SMU Master of Liberal Studies program, where students can customize their degree, like former student Dr. Candace Bledsoe, educator and community leader in diversity and inclusion. More at smu.edu/GLS.
This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with Texas Monthly executive editor Skip Hollandsworth. His new book is called The Midnight Assassin: Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send email to think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink. Of course, our phone number is 1-800-933-5372. Okay, Austin has these moonlight towers, and probably just about everybody listening has been to Austin, may or may not have noticed these things, but describe them for us and tell us what they have to do with what we're talking about today.
They are giant contraptions, 80 feet tall, and they, in 1890, the city decided to buy these moon towers from the city of Detroit because most cities were taking them down. They were too expensive. There was this idea. What we forget is how dark the nights were in these towns. There were no lights. There were some gas lamps. There were a few incandescent lights peering out of people's stores, coming out of people's stores, but there was no streetlight system. So a lot of cities overcompensated by building these moon towers around their downtowns. Well, Austin decided to build moon towers all over their city to light up the entire city. And when the moon towers were finally lit, a reporter wrote a very curious phrase saying that finally, for the first time in years, Austin citizens can walk the streets in safety without worry of crime, without worry of being attacked. Now, there's some history buffs that are going to say there's no evidence the moonlight towers were built to keep out the midnight assassin. But my thinking is, why would he write that? And why would Austin, at the very time every other city was taking down moon towers, buy some and put them all over the city to light up every part of the city they could? Unless it was to keep something away that had been lurking in the darkness.
Where do you think the killer went after 1885?
Well, every time there was an axe killing, the midnight assassin would get blamed. In 1886, there was one in San Antonio of a servant woman. He was blamed. In 1887, the two young white women were murdered in their beds at a home in Gainesville in North Texas. He was blamed. And then came the killings in Whitechapel in 1888, just as the state capitol was being finished, the largest capitol in the country. The Driscoll Hotel was opening. Austin was perfect, and then these killings began to develop, emerge in the Whitechapel area. Well, because they were look like sort of the similar kind of mutilation of women, the Austin killer was brought up again. And at one point, there was a Malaysian cook who had been a suspect in the Austin killings, who had worked at a restaurant in Austin, who was considered a suspect in at least one of the killings, who had been rumored to have gone by steamer to England. And that story, because he had disappeared right after the killings stopped in Austin, that story got to Scotland Yard, and they began looking for Malaysians to arrest. The point being, in many ways, is that England didn't want one of their own to be the killer, to be Jack the Ripper. It was much easier to figure out that a coarse, uncouth Texas man had come there to do the killings. That way, the sanctity of the English tradition was still untarnished. And Austin, in fact, wanted the killer to have gone to England too, because then it was a certainty that he was no longer going to terrorize their own city. So the rumor began, and once that rumor got started, it was hard to stop. At one point, Scotland Yard, when they couldn't find a Malaysian cook to arrest, they arrested some cowboys who had been working at Buffalo Bill's Wild West show that had come through England and had stayed on for a year because they liked England so much. Well, Scotland Yard thought maybe these cowboys were from Texas, and they had turned themselves into a kind of killers of the women in Whitechapel.
Who was the guy with the missing toe?
Well, there was one black suspect who had four toes, and a sheriff said that he saw a footprint by one of the bodies that looked like it had been a four-toed footprint. And we forget, you know, and so everybody had this hullabaloo. Well, now that's the killer. So it's the four-toed black man who had done it, and he had been shot earlier by police, so there's nothing to worry about. Footprints are very hard to make real determinations as to who fit them back then. It's, you know, they were sort of half indented, half not. The evidence was not clear that this four-toed black man had done the killings. On the other hand, there's no evidence to particularly put him away.
Do you think if this happened today, there's any question that law enforcement would be able to figure it out?
Well, you would have, when the second killing would have taken place, FBI agents trained in behavioral science from Quantico would be racing in to do profiles of the crime scene and come up with a profile of the potential killer. There would be Crime Stoppers with rewards all over the city. There would be task forces developed by the local police department. And all the science of criminology would come to play. DNA, blood, that sort of thing. And so it seems like the killer would be caught very quickly, right? But this was a very brilliant killer. He slipped into places. He stalked women. He murdered them, and then he escaped undetected. He did it over and over and over for the course of a year. And then, just as he brought the city to the verge of panic, with people racing into downtown Austin to stand under the gas lamps, the only place left with light in the city after the Christmas Eve killings, he disappeared. He walked out of history. Maybe he would have been smart enough to have beaten the modern criminologists.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Marcia on the line in Navarro County. Hi, Marcia.
Hi, Chris. You just asked the question I had, which was, did Mr. Hollingsworth and the other researchers reach a point where they felt, man, if I just had this piece of information, I could prove?
I'm even convinced, Marcia, that it's still out there. That someone's going to read this book and call me up and go, you idiot, if you had just gone to the New Braunfels Library, there's a diary written by the killer that's in the back in somebody's archives. Or, hey, I just found something in my trunk up in the attic, and this might give you an idea. I mean, it's this ridiculous hope I still have that this 120-year-old mystery can be solved.
Why do perfectly nice, honest people who would not hurt a fly love stories like this?
Why do we love the dark side? Why is true crime? I mean, I'm even interested in this question. Why is true crime making such a comeback in television, in books? There's something that keeps luring us back to these mysteries of people crossing the line. I'm still not sure why I'm so interested in it. Some people say it's because I came from such a white bread background that I like being around people of darkness. But I don't know. I don't know.
Did you read this kind of thing when you were a kid?
No.
Really?
Absolutely not. I really got interested when Charles Albright let me come see him to talk about whether he did or did not cut out the eyeballs of prostitutes.
What do you think is there an amount of time after which we can talk about these things in a slightly different way? I mean, that still feels like a relatively recent story. You know, there are adults listening who aren't too much older than you and me who remember that clearly. And there may be people younger than us. You know, but you hear about certain things and they don't seem quite as scary. You know, we talk about John Wesley Hardin, and that's kind of, you know, wrapped up in the romance of the Old West, but he was a serial killer.
John Wesley Hardin, you know, this is from – there were serial killers that existed. This guy was not the first. John Wesley Hardin shot 40 people. He was the greatest killer in the history of the West. But he was very public about it, and he said that everyone – he shot deserved it. And then there were people that were known as, quote, maniacs who went on psychotic killing sprees and were easily caught. But never had there ever been seen a man who slipped out of his house, did a killing, slipped back into his house, changed his clothes, and waited a period of time until the bloodlust came up again and he decided to do another killing. He did not randomly slay one woman after another. He stalked his victims. He ritualistically murdered them. He laid them out in the backyards as works of art. Nowhere had this ever happened in American history before.
Were you hoping that finishing the book would close the story for you?
Well, the reason it took so long to not write the not write the book was I kept thinking, if I just hold out a little longer, there's going to be something that'll break. And I kept thinking, I'm used to writing stories with a resolution, with a third act. The killer is identified. He's taken off to prison. Case closed. Move on to the next story. That there was no way this is a real book because the story is so wide open at the end. There are more questions than answers. Then it occurred to me, that's precisely why to write the book. It's the reason that we're still drawn to Jack the Ripper all these many years later. And certain people are drawn to the Midnight Assassin. It's a case that's the perfect crime story, except there's no ending.
Skip Hollingsworth is executive editor at Texas Monthly. His new book is The Midnight Assassin, Panic, Scandal, and the Hunt for America's First Serial Killer. He'll be speaking tonight to Arts and Letters Live at the DMA. Skip, it's always a pleasure.
Thank you, Ms.
Chris.
Us.
Thanks.